Hey, welcome back, guys. It's totally unrelated. I just landed, just got back from Hartford, Connecticut. Had a great weekend at the Hartford Funny Bone. Thank you to all the staff and people that came out to see the shows. It was really fun. I was there with Greg Morton and Mike Shusta. I can't pronounce his last name. I was calling him Mike S. Michael, I think he goes by. But had a great time with those guys. Greg Morton, if you've never seen him, is a amazing through the roof performer, breaks every single expectation that anybody would have for a comedy show. I think if it was the first time you ever saw a comedy show, the next show you saw would seem less than. I mean, it wouldn't even matter who you saw, it just wouldn't be as dynamic. They don't come as dynamic as this. But that being said, a lot of people might say it's almost its own genre, what he does. It's a performance piece. It's almost like a it's almost just art. It's amazing. But anyway, he's today's guest, and we had a great talk. We sat in the conference room at the Marriott, the Courtyard Marriott there in Hartford, Manchester. I guess the club's actually in Manchester, Connecticut, which is bordering Hartford. So I didn't go actually into Hartford, but I did do a lot of walking around the mall, around the area near the club. Every day I walked about 5 miles, which is something I've never done before. But also a lot of times the hotel isn't near someplace that has a lot of good sidewalks and a safe area. But I needed to get out and stretch my legs a little bit, and it was very sunny. Got some sun on my face, on my legs, and I feel pretty good for having done all that walking. That being said, I think I'm coming down with a cold now. So it's the yin and the yang. It may pass, may just be from traveling. I just got off the plane. I was supposed to fly in. I flew in a day early because it was a cheaper flight. So I left on Wednesday last week. Got there Wednesday night. Went to the contest, which was Clash of the Comics. The Hartford Funny Bone, and it was a good show. I was amazed by how many people in the audience were just there to see a show, not necessarily there to support somebody. And then it was an audience vote. They passed out a ballot. You picked two, and one of the guys I picked got third. Anyway, it was a good show. I was there for a full week, and then I was supposed to fly out today at 8 o'clock. At 8 o'clock today, and I had to check out of the hotel at noon. So I was gonna just hang out at the airport or whatever for 8 hours, or at the mall till it closed, then go to the airport. I didn't do it. So the reason I realized I did that is because the last time when I was looking at flights to book this, the only other option was to leave at 5:45 in the morning, and you never know what that Sunday show is gonna be like when Monday's a holiday. So I was pretty tuckered. I left right after the show and went back to the hotel. Couldn't get to sleep till about midnight. Woke up at 4. Had scheduled a cab ride for 4:20 a.m. and 4:25 he hadn't showed up, so I had to call Salim, and he said, "I will be your cab will be there in 5 minutes." And sure enough, my cab was there in 5 minutes, more like seven, but we'll say five. And I didn't really understand the sense of urgency. My flight leaves at 5:45. I get in the cab at 4:32. The airport's 22 minutes away. We get there. Thanks to the speediness of the driver. I mean, he was like going 90 at one point in a car that didn't really feel safe over 60. But I didn't say anything. And it wasn't a cab, it was like a Corolla. And it wasn't even like that good a shape. But it only cost me about $10 more than my Uber. And I tried to Uber as a backup when he didn't get there within 5 minutes. I looked and it was going to take 15 minutes for the Uber driver to get there. Turns out that would have been too late. I got there. I moved through security as fast as I've ever moved through security. In fact, I had to stop because I couldn't get my that QR code. It wouldn't show up on my electronic boarding pass, so I had to email it to myself. And I got that up. That was a little panic right there, but that took a minute and a half. I'm through security. I get my shoes off, get my shoes back on. I'm walking to the gate. They're already boarding. I mean, I thought I would have had 20 minutes to spare, but they were already boarding. The flight left 15 minutes early because everybody was there. And I got, all in all, here to Columbus 22 minutes early because the same thing happened with the other flight. So a little bit of stress, all worked out in the end, and a very successful weekend. I premiered my new t-shirt this weekend and sold out pretty much by the second show. Friday first show, I was after Friday first show, I was only down to a couple extra larges, and or a couple double extra larges, one extra large, two mediums and two smalls. So then after the second show, I mean, it was, they were gone fast. And I even told them what sizes I had from the stage, which I realized I've never done that before, but it seemed to speed up the process of not having people stop and be like, oh, because when I ran out of mediums after the first show and other sizes, it was getting a little bit, bottom line, I understand why guys take that big suitcase. Now, I wasn't, you never know what the headliner's going to do. I could have tried to reach out to him, but I didn't know him beforehand, and he wasn't selling anything. So when the headliner's not selling anything, it's a sweet spot for the feature if you're selling something clever, and this new shirt seems to be, people seem to like it. I like it, and I was very happy with that. What else happened? I feel like every time I sit down to do a podcast, there's about 100 things on my mind. I write them down, I talk about them all, and then I edit the podcast, I release the podcast, and then I remember 200 other things that I really wanted to talk about. Now, I don't know if that means I should do a mock run every time, but I just don't have that kind of time. I had a great time with Greg Morton. We talked about comedy. We talked about his beginnings. This might be one of the nicest guys in comedy I've ever met. I mean, maybe one of the nicest human beings I've ever met. We talked for about an hour, so this episode is definitely workout length. And I hope you enjoy this episode. I want to give some shout-outs real quick. Just real quick, I want to give a shout-out to the people that follow the podcast recently. These are the most recent followers. Empress Jules 1964, Laura Bright 777, Denise and Paul, Gary Henry 2000, NMP LCC, thank you. Butterfly Lady 86, Sharon Dearman 123, Laura Cups, Frasita 214, JDC 021, and Rob Wilkins, thank you guys very much for following. Please follow the podcast, guys. Send me a message. Let me know what you like, what you don't like. Review it on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you're listening to it, Podbean, whatever it is. It's available. The app, Podbean app, is available on Google Play and the App Store for Apple. So however you listen, thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy today's episode with Greg Morton. Right there. All right. So I'm sitting here with Greg Morton. We are at the Hartford, Connecticut Funny Bone, which is in Manchester, Connecticut. And we're having a good weekend here. It's both of our first time at this club, if I'm not mistaken.
Second for me.
Second for you? Yeah. When was the last time you were here?
2008.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That was a little while ago.
Yeah.
Was that as a headliner?
Yeah.
And is it the way you remember it?
No, it seems a little, you know, it's such a long time ago. I don't really remember it all that well. I know it went well, but yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny when you first come into a club as a headliner, because sometimes you don't always know, you don't always get your tribe.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying,
yeah.
Right? And so the people who come out to see you, they have different expectations. They don't really know you or what you're all about. And right now, I'm focusing on marketing,
yeah,
which is very important, because I want them to know what to expect.
Bringing your crowd and having them have some level of understanding of what they're about to see can save you a lot of headache and heartache down the road. And it's amazing to me how many comics don't do that upfront footwork. They just go to the club, they know the room's going to be papered or whatever, and they're just like, ah, just do whatever I do. They don't do media, and when they do media, they don't give them a taste of what the act is. So is that what you're talking about?
Yes, exactly. But, you know, Adrian, sometimes you don't know what you are all about.
Yeah.
You know, you're on that path of discovery.
Yeah.
And, well, how do you label yourself?
Yeah.
You know, I
definitely would say I don't know what I'm talking about or what who I am, you know, yet mm-hmm. on stage. I know who I am very much as a man in the world. But a large part of that is my identity as a comedian. Mm-hmm. So then what kind of a comedian am I? That's where I start to lose some things into translation.
Exactly. Like, you know, sometimes, you know, for some people it's obvious, like Puff, you know. He's got that magic dragon yes. thing. It's so easy for him to market.
Right.
You look and you get it right away.
Yeah. There's and no, like, I wonder what this is going to be like.
Right, exactly. And it's easy to build on something like yeah. that. If you're kind of more edgy, then you want, you know, a nice edgy, serious, kind of hard-edged 8x10 kind of shot. The kind of something in the eyes that people look and they go like, oh, this guy's for me.
Yeah.
This guy's going to give me what I want, the edge that I want. He's going to talk about things that I'm interested in. It's going to be interesting. That sort of thing. It can be on a more subtle level.
Yeah. So when you do media, how much of a taste of the act do you give them? Or do you just try to be conversational and friendly? Because you're just come off really, you're like a black John Hamm in that, like, the first time I met you, instantly you like set me at ease, very pleasant, not standoffish at all, just like welcoming, you know, hey, nice to meet you. And a lot of comics that have been doing it for a while don't have that energy. You know what I mean? Like, they're kind of tired of it. And they're like, hey, how's it going? Yeah. And then they do the media, and the media is very much like, yeah, no, we'll do the show tonight. And I always feel like that's such a missed opportunity because...
It is.
You could even go beyond what the act is on TV,
mm-hmm.
or you can short it, but it's obvious what the result's going to be.
Well, there are sometimes, it depends on the situation.
Sure.
And that's what the problem is.
Yeah.
You know, every situation is different. Like every market that you walk into. Now, some people are really good at it. They're very good at improvising or following you.
Sure. I guess it is a skill, right?
It is. It is. And I got to tell you, I was not good at it in the beginning.
Really?
Like, at all.
What
I was terrible at it.
What was it like? I mean, what was, compared to how you are today, what was the first time like?
It was very awkward. I was doing press in Australia, and we had just gotten off the flight, and they were firing all these questions, and I didn't know what to do or how to answer or where to go, and I think I was completely lost. In a morning zoo kind of situation. Everything was very new to me.
Yeah.
And I thought that what you were supposed to do was just come in kind of scripted.
Uh-huh.
You know, because if you do Bob and Tom, that's very scripted, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Not very scripted.
But you can hear somebody act.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they want like you to do some bits.
Yeah.
They want something prepared.
Uh-huh.
They want you to be on.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And there's a... You feel like it's a responsibility. It's almost like doing a, you know, a talk show that you would like the Tonight Show for radio. That's the best way I can describe
it. Okay. Yeah.
So and then flip to another style where people are a little more conversational and they don't want you to do your show or your act.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Which
I didn't
means
think about it.
You more pressure on you to be naturally funny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, what
yeah.
does that mean?
Yeah.
That means that you've got to be comfortable. You've got to be relaxed. You've got to have confidence in yourself that you know that you're funny and you can be funny.
Yeah. On demand. I think that's the mark of a comedian because lots of people are funny. But to be funny at 7 a.m. and then again at 7:30 p.m. and then again at 10 p.m. You know what I mean? As funny as you were last night.
You're selling your show. Yeah. Why would you not want to sell your show? I mean, that's ridiculous. I know a lot of guys, they get kind of grumpy about it. And I've been through that stage, too.
Yeah.
Where I didn't want to, like, I don't want to do this.
Because right.
I've had some bad experiences.
Right.
And then what happens is it builds on that. And you get this thing where, like, oh, I don't want to do this. It all turns out like crap.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So eventually that becomes your reality.
Sure.
Because you're coming in with that attitude.
Mm-hmm.
But if you come in with like, hey, come on, guys, let's do this. And most guys aren't very, they are kind of, what shall I say? Help me out, Adrian. Well, I know they're kind of they're in themselves.
Sure, I think
they only come out when they're on stage.
Yeah, I'd like to think of it as being kind of like the a piece of paper where the edges are burnt, where it's like when you hold it, you're holding it from the middle, so you don't chafe any of these edges. Maybe it's a document like a birth certificate that's important or whatever. So these some of these guys are fragile on the very edge, so they stay very centered in who they are. You know, and if they venture too far out to the edge, you could break some of this document off. You'll never get it back. Because I think for some people, comedy is the end-all be-all, and for others, it's just a job. It's just like, you know, because I've had 9-to-5 jobs. I've had, you know, 10 to 10 jobs. I've had, you know, like 12-hour shifts. And I feel this huge sense of relief inside of comedy because it's all on me. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, it's up to me to get the bookings. It's up to me to write the material, all that stuff. But when somebody is like breathing down your back to sell their pizza, you know what I mean? It becomes a burden. I felt like I was carrying somebody else's dream. And I think some comics feel that same way about this. And I think it can happen over time. I don't think, I think the biggest thing is the grateful versus the entitlement. Mm-hmm. Some comics are just eternally grateful to be able to do this for a living, and other ones are like, can you believe they're making me pay for water?
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. I think it's like those crispy edge guys that find things to keep themselves a little bit angry, maybe, and that maybe translates into the act. I definitely have noticed recently that the general pessimist versus the general optimist and comedians, you know, and the guys that are like, man, wish there was more people here. You know, glass half empty.
Well, I think that a lot of onus is on the comedian themselves because, you know, you have to let people know sometimes how you want to be treated.
Sure.
Or how you need to be treated.
Yeah.
You just give them a little reminder, that's all.
Yeah, it's just a relationship.
You can't be like, you know, the person in the relationship that goes like, well, this person should know how I need my water. Yeah. And I need to be fed. And I need this. And I need that. Now, we're fortunate that we're working with a very professional chain. You know, happy comics, happy show. Happy show, happy audience.
It is really that simple. It really is that simple. And also, you know, they have this market pretty well locked. It appears to me that there's some competition for some of the other comics just to be working this club at all. The guys that aren't feature acts or whatever, but the MCs and the guys that do the split weeks and stuff. And that's good to me. There should be a healthy amount of competition, but I don't know if there's like a B room in Connecticut, in Hartford, like a...
I don't know.
I've never heard of any, so if there's just the one club, it's a relatively large population, which has been very diverse.
Yes.
I feel. Receptive to my, what I would call, and it's very heavy-handed the way I do it, but I play both sides of the fence. Mm-hmm. And I would like to do it more subtly, but when an audience gets it, when I'm doing it heavy-handed and they still appreciate it, I feel a sense of relief because I feel like, I don't want to say doing it more nuanced dumbs it down, but I do like a little sting in it, you know, a little sriracha in my act.
Well, you want it to be subtle. You would like the, you want all different flavors and colors and shades.
Absolutely.
You want that.
So let me ask you this about your act and then we'll shift out of comedy for a minute.
Okay.
When you started headlining, how much of your, when you first started headlining, like on the regular, that headlining became like, okay, this is, I'm a headliner now. How different was your act than it is today? Not necessarily material wise, but spectrum of, let's say, you know, if regular stand-up is one sector and then improv is another sector, and then character work being another sector. How many sectors did you come to the headlining table with? Was it just 2 or 3, and then you developed it into 6? Or was it like, no, I've always been these 6?
Mm-hmm. Well, factors. For me, improv was pretty high up there. The first time, when I first saw a stand-up show just outside of my hometown, which is in London, Ontario, and it was, where was it? trying to think. Oh, no, I'd seen a lot of different stand-up shows, but I never knew that that was my calling.
Yeah.
You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah.
I thought, well, this is a lot of fun and I could, but I my thing was entertainment. Like I was a mobile disc jockey.
Okay.
So I was playing music and records for people.
It's almost like being a comic.
It is, yeah. Right? It is. And in fact, when I had my own business and at the time I was thinking, well, how could I transition into stand-up? And I go, well, I know. I'm doing 4 hours of entertainment. I'll open up by warming up the crowd. So every night, every weekend, I get 5 minutes to try my material in front of a fresh crowd. And as long as I keep it clean, I can do it in front of a wedding audience, a legion.
Which are some of the, like, if you can do well in that situation.
Right?
You can do well in any situation.
Exactly.
So mobile DJ, what did you do before mobile DJ? Was that like your always your thing?
No. Before that, I was an animator. I was a cartoonist.
Good Lord. That's just like, just from comedy to mobile DJ to cartoonist, those are all very unique creative outlets that some people do as a hobby, but would kill somebody to do as a career.
Mm-hmm.
And you've done all of those things as a job.
Yes.
So what about before cartoonist? Just kindergarten. Okay, second grade professional cartoonist.
Well, this is interesting again. My first job was at a Woolworths in a department store as the PA announcer.
Did you go in like, I'd like to bag some, you know, I'd like to be a, you know, stock shelves or whatever?
I didn't even go in. I was recommended.
Oh, God. Jeez. Yeah. You got discovered is what you're saying?
I got discovered.
Well, I got here to Woolworths because I was discovered in the produce section. I said, hey, Mom, that's fantastic. So
because a lot of people, you know, in that situation in retail, they're terrible on the mic.
And they're terrified.
They are.
To be heard or make a mistake.
First thing they do is they blow into the microphone, mm-hmm. which just drives me crazy. It's the quickest way to ruin a microphone. And you know, you and I, we have a lot of respect for our tools, right?
Yes.
You don't blow into the microphone. It sounds terrible. And all the moisture and condensation, right? It builds up in there and then you get...
And you see that dirty mic.
Right?
Oh, God.
So... all roads seem to lead to one place.
Yeah, that's amazing. For me, it was not that way, but I've had some unique jobs,
mm-hmm.
but I always knew I wanted to be a comic, and so my mantra through life, if I took a job, and I was always kind of recommended for jobs, I always almost got the job that I interviewed for because I've always spoke like this.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever recommended me for any voice work other than telemarketing, really, you mm-hmm. know, but I would always say, this is kind of like being a comedian. If I could say that about the job, then I could do the job. But if the job had nothing, no aspect of or way to outlet funny into it, couldn't do it.
So what was your aha moment?
So my first aha moment was when I was watching Saturday Night Live as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that being funny was a job for some people. I didn't realize. I was like, where did they... These people just like, they just put the camera in and they make these things. My mom was like, no, they're professional comedians. And I was like, explain. And the sketch that I saw that really blew my mind was male synchronized swimming with Martin Short. And it was very subtle. It was mockumentary style.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, I want to play with these guys. I want to play with these guys. And I think my whole life I have dyslexia, so I was in learning disabled classes and things. So I had a lot of stories about not being good enough to do things. I overcompensated for not being a quick read. You know, I couldn't read anything very fast, so I overcompensated.
I have the exact same thing.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, it's like a blind person that hears, mm-hmm. you know, exceptionally well or whatever. You develop the things that you're good at.
Right.
And then my next aha moment was... 2005 or 6 or something like that. 6, I'm guessing. It just hit rock bottom from a depression that I had experienced due to the loss of a business. I had been a poker room owner in North Carolina, and which was an illegal poker room, but it was very legitimate for being illegal. Mm-hmm. I sold my share of the company to my partner, and then he got infiltrated and arrested, not even arrested, but just fined, you know, but mm-hmm. everything was this baby that we built together, and then it just disappeared, and it was almost like, it was like watching somebody die in a way, and I've only ever had one friend that I've lost, but I was in a deep depression, and I saw Zach Galifianakis on the Comedians of Comedy, and I was in a really dark place, and I thought, you know, I'd never seen anyone go into the crowd like that before, and just kind of, maybe Don Rickles I had seen, but it didn't really process. This weird looking guy was doing a similar type thing, and I thought, no, that's one thing that I think I could live for, is to try to maybe do that. And then, as I realized I was saying that, my mom called, and she lived in Chicago, and she was like, what's going on? And I had just gotten out of a relationship with the mother of my son, also split up at the same time that the poker thing went bad, so it was a couple other things going on. And she said, what's going on? I was crying, and I was just not coherent, and she said, okay, all right, well, I'm going to call you in a little bit. And I said, okay, I got off the phone, and then, like, 2 minutes later, my sister calls me, who also lives in Chicago, and she said, Adrian. I said, what? She said, what are you doing? I said, nothing. And like at this point, I could hear in her voice what I couldn't hear in my mom's voice, which was a sense of concern. And she said, well, whatever it is you're doing, you need to get your shit together. Mom just left. She's coming to get you.
Wow. Is that right?
And my mom came and helped me kind of pick up the pieces. And we moved all my stuff back to Ohio.
Yeah.
And I stayed with my dad for a while. I had a nervous breakdown, but it wasn't diagnosed really, but it was one of those things where I couldn't really go outside for a couple months, couldn't really interact with anybody that I wasn't already really close with without having like maybe a breakdown and crying or just. And then I just kind of was like, it's time to get over this. So I did some work. I did this thing called Landmark Education, which is like the Amway of self-help. But it just gave me an opportunity to share and understand my story and do some self-reflection and then speak into a microphone. Mm-hmm. And people told me after that, they were like, you know, you really have a good mic voice. You have a good presence up there. And I was like, oh my God, that's like being a comic.
Yeah.
So that was like it was really like coming out of a phoenix, coming out of the ashes, rising from the ashes, I like to think, except maybe more like a pigeon instead of a phoenix rising from the doo-doo. But not to tell too much of my own story, but it was one of those things where it still took me 5 years from that point to find the stage. Once I found comedians, I found my tribe, mm-hmm. and then it was blazing.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think we all have predetermined life paths to an extent. And if we're not on them, we don't feel centered.
Yeah.
We just know intuitively that we're not on the right path.
Yeah. Yeah. I had these visions. I would have visions of being on stage doing stand-up, but no memory. It was like future memories. And now...
Okay.
And now, I don't have those anymore. You know what I mean? I just have memories. They all kind of sunk together. It was almost like, this is my reality and this is my destiny, and at what point do they intersect and then take the same trajectory?
It was kind of your nudge.
Yeah. I mean,
it had to happen.
I felt like I was really close to death or not caring whether I lived or died, and I think that kind of examination...
Well, because that was the death of the old you.
Yeah, right? Wow, I've never even thought of it. No. Well said.
And you were lamenting letting that go.
Yeah.
Because you thought you were losing something.
It was survival, right? Right.
But you're not.
Yeah, no. Well, I think that's where a lot of people are, especially even today politically. I had a guest on my podcast who said, it's, your political affiliation in this country is becoming more important than your patriotism. You know what I mean? Like, we're not just Americans anymore. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, you're red or blue American or in the middle. And I try to think of it in terms of, like, everybody's got things that are important to them, but I never want to have somebody tell me what should be important to me. Mm-hmm. I should be able to figure that out for myself.
Right.
And I think a lot of this political stuff is like, from Bush to Obama, I can't tell a difference in my day-to-day.
Right.
What do you feel about, like, as the Canadian, how do you look at the American political system other than as a joke? But like, it's got to be comical from Canada looking down, literally, towards the United States. Do you have the same follies?
Well, one thing, I find American politics a lot more interesting than Canadian politics. It's certainly more entertaining for me. I would say I was more liberal.
Yeah.
Then I became more conservative, and now I'm like, this is all theater.
Yeah, that's where I went to.
And I became very detached. And then once I became detached, it seemed to go better for me.
Yeah.
I felt like, well, you know, this is, who cares? This doesn't really, these people getting worked up all over this stuff.
So worked up. And I always feel
ridiculous.
Like, let's see how this goes. I've had people that I thought couldn't be managers of a restaurant and turned out to be great managers. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of one of those things that's like, the country can't take 4 years of this person, it would be a disaster. It's like, it never has been. Mm-hmm. It's never been a disaster for anybody.
The president is a figurehead.
Yeah. It's a scapegoat, really. Can we blame this person and can they handle the blame? You know, I think Jimmy Carter was a good example of not being able to handle the blame very well. And I think he did handle the blame, but just, yeah, I messed up.
I mean, they have advisors. They have people that tell them the options. And, well, listen, if you only have so many options to choose from,
right,
then your choices are limited.
Sure.
If you just go with those choices.
Sure.
Not a thinking person who would go like, well, wait a minute, who thinks outside the box? See, that was Obama's problem. Is that Obama would think too long on a problem. And, you know, no action is the same as an action.
Yeah.
It's still an action.
Yeah.
And these type of things, people want to make a decision. Now, one thing you can say about Bush, you can say, like, he may not have always made the right decision.
But he made a decision,
and he stuck to it, and he believed in it.
Yeah.
But to be crippled or crippled by a decision.
Yeah.
And wait so long that the window of opportunity
passes you
completely, like Syria.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you cross this line, then the line was crossed, and then nothing happened.
Yeah.
And now we have this huge crisis.
It was a lot of missteps. What I would say, hindsight's 20/20, but I think my biggest complaint about the Obama administration is the drone war, just the war in general and the way it was mismanaged. It was pretty clear when he was coming into office that things, you know, weren't going well in Iraq and weren't going to be getting any better under the prime minister that they had or President Maliki or whatever. And but they doubled down on him. They doubled down on this leader and things got even worse. And he was plucking out military people, you know, top military people, and putting in his own people. And now those top military people are the top military people in ISIS.
Right.
And so to me, it's just one of those things where it's like, Obama going in knew we shouldn't have been there in the first place, but didn't really do any backpedaling on it. You know, he's like, we're going to close Gitmo. Didn't happen. We're going to do all these other things. And I think once you get in the job, you realize, like, you know, what's possible and what's not possible.
Exactly.
And I think that when you start saying that these things are possible and people start believing that they are possible, sort of same with Trump. He's going to get in office if he does and find out
what is. He's going to find out the exact same thing.
Yeah, what
is. There are some things he can do and things that he can't do.
Let me ask you this about being a Canadian. How do you feel about your healthcare system there?
Oh, hang on. For a quick second, I wanted to comment on that, what you said. I also feel that watching these presidents, you know, like when you watch Clinton, you know, Clinton could really empathize with people.
Yeah.
And people seem to feel a real connection with him. They felt like, well, at least he's listening. You know, when he'd say things like, I feel your pain, it really seemed like he did feel your pain, that he empathized.
I've been moved by his speeches on television, and I find it very difficult to be moved by a speech on television. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to laugh at comedy than when I'm watching it on television. I'm much more in the vibe of where it's going when I'm in person, but gifted orator is like too mild of a statement for him. And I think that played very well as the president, but he also, whether he encouraged it or was a factor in it or not, he held up a very high run of political, or like, so the economy was booming while he's in office, and he's also dealing with a lot of stress in his personal life and just being in office and people fighting against him, and still managed to get some things done. But it's like, when things are going well, it's also hard to manage, you know, with confidence sometimes, because sometimes you get cocky or arrogant. I felt like he maybe was a little bit cocky, but no more than he always was. And as soon as the Bush era came, it was a very outright cockiness, and the economy started to really slump. And so then when that cockiness remained, I was like, this leaves a bad taste in my mouth. But I can't really tell a difference in my life, because my philosophy has always been, doesn't matter who's president, I'm going to do what I do.
Right.
I'm gonna.
But if you were in that other camp, wouldn't you have a different perspective?
What do you mean in the other camp?
If you were more conservative leaning.
Well, possibly. I think the thing is that I think deep down inside I am conservative. I'm fiscally conservative, but socially liberal.
Right.
I'm not, you know, taxes, the IRS, all that stuff. Oh. Don't get me started.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I'm for smaller government.
Right.
I'm not against welfare, but reform is definitely needed. And because I also feel, I mean, like, welfare is like, it's like every other form of insurance that we all pay into. We're just paying to not have our houses broken into every day. And the places that have, you know,
that's true.
There's a lot of places that have very, very socialized everything, you know, and no guns, and theft is still a really big problem because, you know, it's like part of the human condition.
Right.
You know, and if you can get away with things, people will get away with things. I don't think you ever stop. You know, I think the libertarian, where, you know, like, these people will have to fend for themselves. You know, some people just aren't capable. You know, some people aren't capable.
That's very true.
Born stupid. And some people are born to thrive, right? So figuring out who you are, because some people will create more than they need, and other people will never be able to create enough for themselves.
Hey, we all have our lessons to learn.
Yeah.
It's just hard to watch someone repeatedly ram their head into the wall over and over again.
I think that's just the.
It's so frustrating. Right?
Yeah.
But if they don't have the skill set, I mean, you can't really blame them for that.
Sure. And I think also, you know, like George Bush Sr. was clearly a very intelligent man.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I think also, like, I think it's weird that the legacy that we have now in the United States for politics, you know, like they want, you know, the Clintons, the Bushes,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the families and the Kennedys. I saw, can't remember, she's the ambassador to Japan, and she's like a Kennedy heir.
Oh, yes.
And terrible speaker. They were interviewing her on the news, and I was just thinking, like, she's only got that job for one reason. One reason only. And it's not like the ambassador to Japan is this, like, terribly important
job. She needs to practice her media skills.
But it was like one of those things, like, clearly she's not even trying to practice the media skill. And it was just like, I just need this because I'm a Kennedy and I want to carry on the legacy. I don't even know if she wanted the job. It seems like that at that level of Kennedy, mm-hmm. you could be pushed into doing things not because you wanted to, but because it's important to keep the name alive, because there might be a younger Kennedy that needs to ride on her coattails.
It was given to her, you know, in recognition of her support.
Yeah. And I think in any ambassadorship, it's an appointment. It's not,
right.
It's not, I think I'll fact check that. I'll have my producer fact check that later. Healthcare in Canada, just general sense, because I've had people tell me that are Canadian citizens that everybody hates it. And I've had other ones say that everybody loves it. And that leads me to tell me that, you know, that the truth is somewhere in the middle.
Well, that's true. The truth is somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the great thing about it is if something happens to you, you're taken care of.
Yeah.
And you won't go bankrupt.
Right.
That's the great thing about it.
Right.
The bad side, the downside is that you have to wait mm-hmm. for that care.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be a year, 18 months
mm.
to get a specialist.
Is that
And then finding a specialist. What's that?
Is there like a geographical, like big city versus small city that makes that harder or easier? Or is it Like if you live in Toronto, is it easier to get healthcare quicker than it is in a smaller
The opposite.
Oh, okay.
Because
population.
Yeah. And demand.
Yeah.
You know, and depending on what your ailment is and how specialized that is.
So if it was
a lot of our specialists have moved stateside because it's the only way they can make any money.
So if you had a more serious, urgent condition, you would have less of a wait time, but it could still be a long wait time. But like, so you get in a car accident and an ambulance shows up, just like here in the United States, mm-hmm. I assume. They take you to the hospital and they fix you up and then send you on your way. But if you have...
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, like you broke a bone or something like that, do they take care of all of that like in an emergency situation?
Exactly. You pull out your health card... And then it goes that way.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then if you like went to the checkup, you get a checkup and you find out you got to get X-rays and all this other stuff. That could be a long drawn out process.
Let me think. I'm trying to think of something that would give you. If you need a special surgery,
yeah,
that could wait. You would have to wait a long time. I mean, I'll give you an example. I don't even have a doctor. There are so few doctors right
really?
Now.
Really? Huh. That's interesting.
Well, I'm living in Toronto.
Yeah.
It's a big city. There, doctors are charging. They're just like, well, I've got as many patients as I can handle.
Yeah.
I'm not taking any more.
Yeah.
I'm not taking any new clients. And I don't really want a new doctor.
Right.
Because I don't, you know, I want someone older with experience.
Yeah.
I need somebody walking in with a cane.
Yeah. Looks like Colonel Sanders.
Right.
Yeah, I agree.
That's who I want my doctor to be.
What about sports? Are you a sport fan at all? Is sports in Canada, is there anything other than baseball and hockey? Do you guys play cricket?
Well, hockey is the main sport, I would say. But in Toronto right now, the Raptors and the Jays are on fire.
Okay.
And the Raptor love is incredible.
Really?
Just incredible. Well, they did some really smart marketing with the Raptors. And what they did was they promoted their product to young immigrants.
Wow.
Asians, South Asians, East Asians. When you go to Jurassic Park, it's a very diverse group of people.
Huh.
You'll see people from the islands,
and
Trinidad, Jamaica.
And they've had... I don't follow basketball, but they've had success. They've been a good basketball team, right?
Yes.
So that helps as well. Wow, that's interesting. What about, is there any soccer in Canada, any professional soccer?
Yeah, Toronto has a team. I think some of the other cities do. I'm not sure, right? I do know that Toronto. I'm not a big sports guy.
Toronto FC, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and we don't have any football. We don't have an NFL team, obviously. We have a CFL, which is Canadian Football League.
How big is that to Canadians?
It's pretty big.
Yeah.
It's a pretty big deal. I would say less, to a lesser extent in Toronto, but mm-hmm. the other provinces, huge deal.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go out west, places like Saskatchewan, you'll see flags in windows.
Right, yeah.
You know? Yeah. I mean, they're really hardcore, right into their CFL.
So what is...
I never grew up with it, so
yeah.
I don't really have an attachment to any of that stuff.
I know what you mean. What takes the place of sports? What is it that you're doing when you're not doing comedy?
When I'm not doing comedy, like... I'm not a big sports person. I'm more of an entertainment guy.
So
you movies, go with,
yeah,
or movies or games.
Okay,
that's what I like. Media.
What was your first favorite movie?
First favorite movie.
Like the first movie that was like, wow.
Oh, Star Wars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Me too.
Star Wars.
The first Star Wars and the second Star Wars. I remember coming out of the theater thinking like, anything is possible.
You know. Well, there was nothing like that at the time, right?
It's craziness.
Nothing.
Craziness. And then I saw the one, episode one, right? And I was like, what the hell is this? And then two was okay, and three I actually kind of enjoyed. I feel like they really finally got it by mm-hmm. the third one. And then this more recent one. It's pretty good. I really enjoyed it. I saw it with my son in 3D, and I enjoyed it, but it felt soft. You know, it felt a little soft serve to me compared
here's,
to the
here,
first
here's
one.
What how I felt about it. And this is a real problem in Hollywood right now. They are rebooting or remaking these films. They're just using the same beats from the original film. I mean, you think you're going to dupe me?
Right.
You got to give me something new. You got to take some chances story-wise. At least with Lucas, I can say, well, he gave us a new story.
Mm-hmm.
He gave us something different.
Right.
Something to mash on.
But he still went the dad
route. He didn't give us the same sandwich.
Yeah. Yeah. This was just kind of
That really bothered me. It took me a long time to get over that.
Really?
And just enjoy the film.
Was it instant, the feeling that you noticed that?
No,
Did you notice it instantly?
But like I said in my show, like I had very bad experiences going to see that film.
Yeah.
The first time I went, though, I was in the front row of an IMAX showing in 3D. And I really couldn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
I was just way too close.
Yeah.
And you got to be there opening night. If you're not there with all the nerds,
yeah.
you know, and all the energy and everything, it's just not the same. And I got to tell you, the response was very meh.
Yeah.
It's just meh. This is just okay.
Yeah.
I went to see it again, and it was like meh. And I go like, what is going on here? This is Star Wars. I should be loving this, man.
Right, right.
So I finally, then I go like, well, it came out on Blu-ray, and this is after seeing it like three times in the theaters. I got it on Blu-ray, and I sat home, and I watched it with my wife. No distractions, no kids. And I go, wow, this is really good.
Huh.
It's a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. I don't know what it was that I just let go of. I think maybe I just accepted, part of it was that I accepted that it was its own thing.
Yeah.
It was its own
kind of standalone.
Yeah, because, well, not so much a standalone, but what do I want to say? I guess its own franchise in a way, because it has a different stamp on it, different director. So there you're going to have a different feel. I kept thinking, this doesn't feel like Star Wars.
Yeah, that's how I felt too.
And I think that's the absence of Lucas.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
You know?
You're going to feel that.
Now, don't get me wrong. I don't think like Lucas is like...
Yeah, yeah. All hail Lucas.
Right? The problem with Lucas is he became so successful that nobody could say no.
Yeah.
Nobody can say, like, no, George, that's a crazy idea. Everybody just said, yes, George, whatever you want.
Yeah.
And he went off the rails a couple of times. I mean, he needed to be reeled back in there.
Yeah.
There's this thing called story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Kind of important.
Right?
Just kind of. So what, recently, what movies got you excited or... did you see that truly disappointed you? Or what's on?
I've seen a couple of films that have really disappointed me. And one was Batman vs. Superman, which
is
an absolute freaking mess.
Yeah.
Just a mess. Now, the first hour, I'm going like, hey, this isn't so bad.
Yeah.
I'm getting into this. This is a couple of things I had some problems with, but not too much.
Yeah.
And I don't mind the storytelling because that's what I want from a good superhero film, you know? So then it gets just crazy. I go like, oh my God, too many cooks in the kitchen. Get the hell out of there. You've got three or four movies in this one damn movie. You know?
I just can't.
Did you see it or no?
No, I haven't. I couldn't wrap my head around.
Too bad, because we could have a great discussion on that.
Well, I mean, it was one of those things where it was like, I probably would have gone to see it with my son, but I heard so many bad things, and he said the same thing. He's like, Dad, none of my friends liked it. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, none of my friends liked it.
You know, it upset me so much. I wanted to go see it again just to figure out why it doesn't work. Why?
What did you think of the first Superman reboot?
I didn't like that at first either. And then I watched it again, and my wife says, well, just watch it again. And I'll go, okay, I will watch it again. And I actually grew to like it. I think the thing that bothered me the most is the way they chopped up the storyline.
Yeah.
Like, the stuff with his father was the best. Oh, I was so invested in that, his relationship with his dad.
Yeah.
Like, I was almost crying.
Yeah.
When his dad died,
and
I'm like, And then they would cut right away and they'd go to something else. I go, like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I'm still mourning the death of his dad. And this is really important to me. Yeah. This is important to a lot of people because I think a lot of people can relate to that. That father-son relationship.
I absolutely agree.
Right?
I was...
So why would you rip somebody out of that and then go back to this fantasy and just pull people right out of that?
Yeah.
That's the most important part of this story.
Yeah, I got it right away. I mean, like, I got wrapped into it right away. I don't know how I felt about the movie, but I felt like they did a really good job with casting, mm-hmm. recasting the Christopher Reeves position with a guy.
Agreed.
Who probably had Christopher Reeves rolling over in his grave. You know, for like, God damn, this guy looks like me, except he's more handsome. But I just remember, like, watching the first 15 minutes or so, like, I can't believe how good this is. But then over time, after watching it, it was kind of, like you said, it was just like, this isn't as good as the first 15 minutes were. And then Man of Steel, I thought was pretty good, too. Or was that the second one? The second reboot? Or was that the
Man of Steel is the second reboot, and then what the heck is the first one? No, what is it? Man of Steel, man, I'm having a hard time here.
Yeah, I don't remember either. All I know is that neither one of them, like, really stick out in my mind the way that the first three Superman movies did, you know, right. with Christopher Reeves. And yeah. so I don't know yeah. what the future of the reboot is. Did you see Ex Machina?
Yes.
What'd you think of that?
Loved it.
Me too.
What a great, smart science fiction film.
Yeah.
That felt so old school and yet new again. And I just love that film. Now, that's a film that I would have in my collection.
Yeah, me too.
I would buy that.
Yeah, I would too. Yeah. That's a huge mark because I don't buy films per se, but mm-hmm. if it is something that I'm like, I'm always going to watch this. Did you ever see the movie Spy Game with Robert Redford?
Mm.
It also has Brad Pitt in it. It's mostly Brad Pitt and Robert Redford.
You know, I did. It's fairly old, right?
Yeah, it's, you know, 15, 20 years old probably at least.
Long time ago. I barely remember that.
So. I bought that movie because I was like, I'll watch this movie again, mm-hmm. you know. And I ended up, when I was in my low point, I watched it every day, all day for about 2 weeks. Yeah. The other movie that I did that with was Tropic Thunder. When I tore my ACL, I was on bed rest for about a week, and I watched that movie all day, every day. It was like my Catcher in the Rye.
Isn't that funny? Like, you know, you said that when you lost your business and you felt like you had a death in the family, I went through the exact same type of mourning process. I watched Top Chef, just episode after episode. I wouldn't leave the house. This was after my dad passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And I was exactly the same as you. Just burying myself.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's something that interests you enough. And I wonder what human quality has us. I think it's something like, I can handle this.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I have still do this to this day. I have things that I watch obsessively. Not that I'm actually actively watching it mm-hmm. sometimes, but... At night, I put on Arrested Development, the television show, because
mm-hmm.
it's on Netflix. There's no commercials, and it'll play 3 episodes and stop, and then mm-hmm. the TV's off. And I like that, but I also could watch a different show. But I know this show in and out. I know almost line for line, so I can just go to bed. I know it's like I don't know if it's an Asperger spectrum or an OCD spectrum type thing, but. I think it comes from a different place than where I was at the low point watching Spy Game over and over again. Because that was just really like,
So you'll watch the same episode?
No.
So, what do you mean?
So like if I watch Arrested Development, I just like, it'll play 3 episodes, not in a row, not the same one, but like episode 16, 17, and 18. Then it stops.
Oh, because you're watching on Netflix.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then I'm not like, I'm on episode, I don't know what episode I'm on right now. But if I was going to take a nap, I'd pull it up on my laptop. Hit play, probably roll over the other direction, and just listen to the voices and know what the scene looks like.
Well, you know, we're on the road and you're by yourself. And
I just don't want to be one of these guys that like 20 years, I'm like huddled in the corner of the meeting room, like I can't sleep in a regular room and I've got, you know, my media here. I feel like you can get trapped into these little boxes, like I said, the crispy edges.
Well, we have too much, don't we?
Yeah.
We got way too much. I'm looking at Netflix. I can't even make up my mind.
That's the thing. You can scroll Netflix for an hour.
I'm like that little kid at the mall. And the mother's going, do you want this flavor or that flavor or that flavor? And they go through all 52 flavors. Yeah. I mean, that's too many choices.
There is such thing as too much choice. And that, and not enough, because I feel like in the political system, we got two choices. That's not really even a choice.
I've always thought that there should be a third party here. Why isn't there a third party?
I think there
party?
Should be. I don't think you could get away with a third party, because once one party had more than 33% of the electorate, they would take that second party and be like, look, you can come along, but we got to get rid of this third party. Because even in a two-party system, like, you know, if you listen to Fox News or some of the Fox News anchors, they say things like defeating liberalism. Mm-hmm. And that to me is like they don't want to get their way. They want to obliterate the other side. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And to me, that's not how this country was founded. You know what I mean? Right. It's like, to me, we make the most sense when we both come together and say, well, this is what I want. Well, this is what I want. Well, what can we both get? You know, a compromise is when both parties feel sufficiently screwed, right? it's not about getting everything that you want. And I feel like we're really becoming very selfish.
In Canada, there's more than one party.
I mean, yeah, and I think that...
There's the Liberal Party, the Conservative Party, the New Democratic Party, the Green Party.
Are they all equal?
The Pod Party.
Yeah. You know? Are they, like, there's clearly some that are, like, more viable than others, though, right? Does it ever just come down to two of the two parties as the main party class?
Sometimes people will vote for whoever's the best candidate.
Yeah.
And there have been districts where the Green Party's actually got in. Now, would they get in federally? No, they're too young. They're too new. People don't know, and primarily they'll stick with either the Liberals or the Conservatives. Uh-huh. Now, provincially, the NDP will get in sometimes, but Canadians have never been comfortable with going that far left and going to a new Democratic government. But it almost did happen in the last election.
Really?
The New Democratic Party was in the lead.
Huh. So, now... What happened in Toronto with, that was Rob Ford, right?
Right.
How did that happen?
Well, we had a really liberal mayor before that. And this is the straw that broke the camel's back. There was a strike among the sanitation workers. And what they did was, this was the solution, while they were on strike, they had everybody dump their garbage in the public parks for the whole summer. So the kids couldn't play baseball, they couldn't go outside and play in the park, because everybody's garbage was stacked up in the middle of the public parks. Mm-hmm. And you know, in a city like that of over 4 million people, you know, you need your parks, right?
Yeah.
So then at the end of that summer, He capitulated, gave them what they wanted. And why didn't you just do that in the first place? So then they take all the garbage out, and they're just mad. They're like, this is ridiculous. We've had enough. And so they swung to the very far right. Mm. And that's what I think is happening in this country.
I agree.
People are trying to right the ship.
Yeah.
So they went for Rob Ford, and he was just like Trump. A plain talker, plain speaker, you know, very short bullet point type. So he was very good at communicating his message. He would say things like, stop the gravy train.
Yeah.
And people are going like, yeah, stop the gravy train.
We should stop the gravy train.
Excessive spending, this government spending. You know, you're not putting any value on the money that I pay with my taxes. This is not even important to you. And people get angry. And you're speaking for these people. They came in and they voted Rob Ford in. And he did a lot. Initially, he did a lot of things that he said he would do.
Mm-hmm.
And it did work well. However, there still has to be, it's a large city, there still has to be growth.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so we ended up becoming stagnated, and no one... We couldn't move any further. And there were all these fights all the time. So in order to move on, We had to have another. Unfortunately, Rob got sick and he passed away. And we got another mayor. He's still conservative, but he's a more progressive mayor. And so he understands that there needs to be a balance, and mm-hmm. you have to listen to the people. I mean, you have to think about quality of life
sure.
for the people living inside the city, especially a city that size.
Yeah, yeah. And I lived in Chicago.
Which is a lot like Toronto.
Right. I figured they were somewhat similar in that, like, the leadership in Chicago has always been bad. You know, it's almost right. like an unwinnable situation.
Right.
And with these, with the gun violence issues that they have there, even with the cops shooting people, that's to me where I'm like looking at it like, this is getting ridiculous. You know, at mm-hmm. what point do we, you know, do the people come together and demand more? Or is it that they don't get to demand more? This is, we just get who we get and we ride it out. And we get to kick them out when it's time to kick them out, but you just kind of get who you get.
Well, you know what, Adrian? We're still in the process.
Yeah.
That's why I'm not worried.
Yeah.
I mean, if you were in the middle of the civil rights movement.
Right?
You would go like, is this going to move any further yeah. at all?
That's what I mean by progress is painful and you can't measure it in real time. You have to wait and look back on it because it's always, it's constantly happening. It's like, even though you can't see it, it's inching along millimeter by millimeter. And then you can take a macro view of it over time and be like, oh, you know what? During this period of time, we actually were doing pretty
exactly.
We
didn't. It's like that story in your show where you yeah. talk about going to the theater with your dad.
Yeah.
A theater that, you know, your dad couldn't even get into.
Right.
He couldn't even go to the theater.
Which it still blows my mind. In fact, we did a StoryCorps on NPR where we went to the van and they recorded it and everything like that. And that was what I talked about with him because, to me, that's still the most fascinating parallel between my dad and me is that he is a doctor, mm-hmm. you know, it was as successful as I think anybody could actually be, regardless of race, but he really was playing against a fixed system, a rigged deck, so to speak, and, you know, to just like colored drinking fountains and not being able to go to the, you know, just not being able to go somewhere because of the color of your skin to me is just one of those things that I didn't grow up with. We grew up with it in sort of more nuanced ways, mm-hmm. more nuanced racism, but like the outright racism, can't even imagine what that was like.
Well, the outright racism, at least you can see it.
Yeah.
And you know where it is. You can see it coming, you know where it's coming from, you know who it's coming from. And you can protect yourself.
I agree.
The other one, you can't.
Because right.
you can never lay, you can never point fingers.
Yeah.
You never know. People can deny it. They go like, well, no, I'm not. No. Yeah. Not even realizing in yeah. some cases true. That they are
true.
Racist.
True. And that's funny that you say that. I lived in Mississippi for 2 years and I was very safe. And even though I was living on the other side of the, you know, it was a very segregated town, but I hung out at the white bar. I worked with, you know, mm-hmm. I worked at a great job. It wasn't like I worked. When the cotton comes in, that's when everybody in the town is working. And when the cotton's not in, nobody's working. So there's a couple prisons that they built in this town. So that's the other big industry. And everything else is pretty small-timey shop work, fast food or something like that. But I remember thinking I was pretty lucky to be able to hang out where I was hanging out because I fit in more with these, you know, racist white people than I did with the racist black people. Because both of them were racist, you know, for their own reasons or whatever. And it was very easy for me to see it, but the racist black people were like just as unwelcoming to me I felt less welcome in the South from the blacks than I did from the whites. And I don't know where that starts. I don't know if it's my articulation, the way I speak.
Oh, yes.
Or maybe because I already had a good job and I'm not from there.
Did you ever figure it out?
Never really figured it out. But I think, you know, in my life, I have a very wide diversity of friends, you know, mm-hmm. all colors, all races or whatever. But intelligence is always what I'm drawn to. And when I was in Mississippi, the only like smart friends I had were the people I worked with that came from other places. Right. Not to say that nobody from the town was intelligent. It's just that I was like, my best friend was a guy who just graduated from Purdue.
Well, in the total scheme of things, we're not really that far away.
Mm-mm.
Not really that far along, really.
Yeah,
I mean, this is going to take...
It's been, it's like literally in our lifetime, things were
right
pretty shitty.
Exactly.
Yeah. So progress is progress. I'm glad we're at where we're at now. I certainly don't have any complaints. Let's wrap up on this. Talk to me about voice work. Before that, how many times do you get confused with the professional football player?
Whenever anybody Googles my name, that comes up.
Well, this is what happened. I Googled you.
Yeah.
Wanted to do a little research, and it's your picture and his bio from Wikipedia. And I was like, he used to play football. I was like, not in 1970, dude. He is not that old. I said, but.
Do you think somebody did that as a goof, or what do you think that is?
I don't know. I think it's just Google trying to. I think there's a lot more on you than there is on him, so they just assume you're the same person.
Interesting. I guess.
I don't know. I mean,
I actually had a professional football player come out to my show.
Thinking I was
in the NFL. And
why didn't you talk about the football, man? You play football? Did you do that in the locker room?
It's exactly. He came out, he looked at me, and he went, this guy plays football.
You must have been in the CFL.
It was hilarious. And then I had another guy at this hotel. He worked at this hotel. He Googled me, and he was convinced that I played football. He thought I was this football celebrity. He sat down and talked to me about football for an hour. And there was no convincing him that I was the other. So I just went along with it. I go, what else am I going to do?
Yeah, relax.
And he did all the talking, so he made it easy.
And it was interesting. Crazy people are always the most interesting. It's funny how that works. So voice work is something that's always fascinated me. I never have... I've done a couple commercials.
Yeah.
Nothing major, just local stuff. But you do a lot of voices in the act.
Yeah.
And you've done them professionally.
Mm-hmm.
How does that happen? Do you have a voice agent? Did you just audition for these things?
I had an agent, yeah.
Yeah.
And I told my agent, I had a conversation with him one day. I said, hey, would you send me out on a couple of auditions? I used to do this when I was in college. I would do voices for my fellow students' animated films.
Uh-huh.
And he said, sure. And
So is that where it came from, the animation? Doing your own animation, you brought life to your own characters, or?
I did voices for our animated project, which was, it was just an animated short called The Younger Boys.
Uh-huh.
And it was a poem about this gang, in the West, and we had this. It was a really, really cool cartoon. Very, very. I haven't seen it in a long time, but
is it out on the? Is it on the web?
You might be able to find it. Yeah. I'm gonna Google it and see if I can have a look. See if I can find it. And I did this old prospector voice, The younger boys came riding. The younger boys came riding over the hilltop, or something like that. Then I did voices for other people's films. They would want a cat or a dog or that's... I forget what it was. School, I was your baby. I was doing a dog voice for somebody else's character. And then I just thought, I had a lot of fun doing that. I think I'd probably be pretty good at this.
And when you're already doing stand-up, when you're actually...
I was already doing stand-up, yeah.
And then, so...
But I was only into it about... 2 or 3 years. Hadn't been in it that long.
Oh, stand up?
Yeah.
Okay, so let me ask this question. On the best day of voice work, the best day of stand up, what's better?
Well, here's how I made the decision. I think that comedy is a jealous mistress. And I had to marry comedy. Because I knew that I wouldn't get any better at comedy unless I fully committed. I had to fully commit because it requires so much of your being.
Yeah.
You can really, it's very difficult to take some time off and just go do something else and then come back to stand up. I mean, you get rusty in a week.
I'd been off 7 days exactly when we went up on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like last night, second show, I was like, all right, I got it back.
Right? You feel
fifth
like
show.
The well-oiled machine.
Again, yes. Yeah. And I am off next week. So I'm
me too.
Yeah, so I'm pounding to try to find out, like, how can I not be off for 13 days before I go on stage again? But there's something I find about, like, that short gap, maybe 10 days. When I come back to it, I have a hybrid vigor, which is like I'm so excited to be back on stage that yep. I take a whole new level to it. And then sometimes if I have to follow, it's like especially on one-nighters. So like that might be a Wednesday and I'm like, man, that was awesome. And then I take it to Thursday, where Thursday has this dynamic in some parts of the country as being the day before Friday. You know what I mean? Like some people will go out and party it up on Thursday and other people will play it safe by going to a comedy show. You know what I mean? And you need kind of a mix of those two people that are partying it up and playing it safe on a Thursday night crowd for it to be like a really great show. But for some reason, I feel like I've had better shows on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. And Thursdays is almost always feels like a dress rehearsal for Friday and Saturday.
It's an odd night, isn't it? The Thursday night.
Just depends on, you know, who you bring and who shows up. I went to the contest. They had a contest on Wednesday mm-hmm. at the Funny Bone because I came in a day early and I went to that. And it was, I mean, it wasn't as busy as second show last night, which was our smallest show of the week so far.
Well.
But it was still a good crowd. And I asked the people around me, are you here to see someone specific? Because it was a contest. They said, no, we just wanted to see a show.
Yeah.
On a Wednesday?
I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. You know, on a Thursday, your tribe's not coming out
Thursday. Yeah, yeah.
There's no tribe there.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the mix of people that we had on the Thursday.
That's true. Yeah, you know what? That is interesting. That's people that are like, yeah, what, anything else to do. But you're right. The tribe nothing, goes when it's best.
And I'll tell you something. Nothing invested, nothing gained.
Agreed.
If you put down your money, you'll meet the person, you'll meet the comic halfway. You'll go like, well, I expect to have a good time.
Yeah, exactly. I call it this better be funny versus this isn't going to be funny.
Right?
Because if they start off with this isn't going to be funny, you could be as funny as you want. They might be laughing, but they still have that initial first response.
Then you're constantly proving yourself.
Yeah.
That's all you're doing.
I listened, because I don't read well, but I listened to this book, Power of the Pitch, and one of the things he said about that was, you know, be willing to walk away if things aren't going your way or whatever. And I thought, well, that's not really an ability in stand-up to walk away, but you can walk away from the deal. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have to say yes to everything, and that was kind of powerful to me. But also,
you've never done that or had that.
What do you mean? Like, until just very recently, I've done everything that's ever been asked of me and done the full contractual time. I've not always had, but I don't have any real horror stories. You know, I've bombed, you know, more times than I can count, but pretty lucky in that I've never had anything aggressively scary happen to me. I'd say just the biggest thing up until this year was as long as I don't lose too much money, I'll do it. And now for me, it's got to be like, I have to be able to turn a profit for me to do it. So not even for be in order for me to do it. I'll do things locally for free and stuff like that.
You know, I think that you have to recognize your abilities and your self-worth.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to make a commitment to that and never undersell yourself.
Right.
Those people, those other gigs will still exist.
Right.
But they should only have that level of product.
Exactly.
If they're not paying anything, they shouldn't get anything special.
Exactly. And that was the point I was trying to dig at. I couldn't get there. Was that people don't appreciate things that they haven't invested in. They have mm-hmm. no attachment to things that they don't have a personal stake in. And sometimes that might just be $5. But sure. that gesture of $5 is a lot. For instance,
It's still an investment.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's actually saying like that this is worth it. And then when it is worth it, you get to pat yourself on the back for being right. I knew that would be worth it. It's like blackjack or anything. I knew I should have taken.
I think that's what laughter is.
Yeah.
Because when we present a setup and a punch and the people get it, it's like, oh.
Yeah.
I figured out the puzzle.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You're right.
It's congratulations like to me.
Yeah.
You know?
I got that. And that's why sometimes that inside joke that only a couple people get, you know, because it's obscure or whatever, they're laughing the hardest because they know other people didn't get it, but they did get it. Yeah, you'd have to know. You'd have to have seen all five episodes.
And it's the same reason that people will laugh along with the rest of the crowd.
Exactly, even when they don't know. Out. Yeah, exactly. Blah, 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 blah. Dang it, killing it. That was the best boobity-bop.
Isn't that hilarious?
It is. Okay, we'll wrap on this. What?
I think this is a two-part podcast.
It could be. You know, this is the last two interviews I did went about 1:15, and I aired straight through. This one doesn't seem like it has any hard edits in it. So what I call that is a two-parter myself, but I always air it in one episode. And a lot of my listeners are from this app called MyFitnessPal. Mm-hmm. It's a community. It's not really just an app, but it's people that work out and track their eating, or maybe it's just they're tracking their fitness. I use it to track my weight and to make sure that I'm eating a balanced nutrient diet, at least when I'm in season. Like right now, I'm eating elephant ears, I'm eating everything in sight. I'm not really giving myself a pass because I know come fall, I'll be training again.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, so just kind of trying to, it keeps me sane, you know, because if I was like trying to really monitor and still work out, but really take it easy, I know I would push myself. You know, I ran across the street the other day and I was like, oh yeah. Like I felt that feeling like I could do this, but I know if I start running more than across the street, I'm going to mess up my back again. So.
Oh, I see.
So a lot of my listeners.
It's not fully healed then.
No. It's going to take a while for the muscles around it to rebuild because they went in, you know, with like a poker or whatever and pulled out pieces of cartilage and then shaved down the disc.
Damn.
Really one of those things. And here's, I guess, you know, to my benefit, I just moved to Columbus and I was having excruciating back pain and I called, you know, a couple doctors and finally somebody was like, you need to go to the emergency room for this. And I went to the emergency room and had surgery 6 hours later. You know, had an MRI within 3 hours, and they were like, this is pretty serious. It wasn't going to kill me, but it could have caused some paralysis.
Oh.
And yeah, so I'm very thankful that I had good insurance, and I went to a great hospital that was able to get me in, had everything on site. I was there overnight, I left 24 hours later. And
what created the problem in the first place?
I don't know, but I think I'd been dealing with a repetitive stress injury in my back for since my 20s.
Okay.
You know, I'm 40 now, and I think I just had this thing where I did something. I worked with kids a lot when I was younger, like after school care and stuff. Mm-hmm. Took them to school in the morning. And I remember having back pain when I was about 21 for almost a year, pretty chronically. And then it got better when I started sleeping on a waterbed. And then every, you know, year and a half, 2 years, I'd have a pain spat with my back where I would be hunched over for a couple of days because I slept on a pillow wrong or something. And since the surgery, though, all of that's been gone. All of that nagging, kind of like my spine did kind of like this S curve at the bottom. And that's how I knew something wasn't right. So I started, instead of resting on my right leg, I would always rest on my left leg thinking that would overcompensate. But it was like literally within a couple of days of that I had the surgery because it was just getting so bad. It was like, you know, my spine would come up and then make a right and then go like that. And I think that was the bulge causing it. And right. So once they shaved that down, I realized like, oh my God, I'm standing straight up again.
Wow.
But I still ran every day and, you know. Well, let's wrap it there, Greg. That was a lot of fun. Where can people find you online?
GregMorton.com, or you can follow me on Twitter or Instagram at GregMortonComic.
Awesome. Thanks so much, man. I appreciate it.
Adrian, pleasure.
Like someone else's dream, he says it's so. Whispers.